In a quiet Wisconsin neighborhood, a teenaged Evelyn Hartley vanished on an ordinary October night. There were footprints in the dirt, blood in the grass, and thousands who searched for her but found nothing. Yet decades later, her name is spoken not for who she was or the true facts about her case, but for the monster she's been tied to. This is her story.
Hi, I'm Vanessa.
And I'm Amy.
And you're listening to She Goes by Jane.
At the end of this episode and every episode, we will be joined by a special guest who will read an original poem by Amy Baker about the women we're featuring.
Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, Amy.
Vanessa, behind the scenes, we've actually been talking for a bit about our practice of not naming perpetrators when we cover missing persons cases.
Yep. We have been.
Right. Because, like, we just use initials. We use filler names. Like, we don't actually use their names at all.
Right.
And you asked me if it felt like we're somehow letting them off the hook, mm-hmm. like, by not naming them or somehow, like, absolving them, even in some sort of small way.
Right. Right. Like, making it so that, like who is responsible for this?
Right.
It's almost like these things are just happening out of nowhere. That's just how I've been feeling a little bit lately. I do believe, like, we should be focusing on the woman that we're talking about, but there's, like, a little part of me that's like, are they getting away with it too easily?
Right, when they're not publicly kind of, like, named and shamed, right?
Right, exactly, exactly.
Yeah, and I agree. It could come across that way, that, like, basically in avoiding their names, like, we're softening what they've done mm-hmm. or disconnecting them from it. But, like, that's not what we want for the women who've experienced violence. And again, not every missing persons case involves a perpetrator.
Right.
But very often they do, right? And we do want our stories to stay victim-centered. So Vanessa and I have been talking about this. And yeah, it's really, like, we've not been naming them because at the end of the episode, like, the names I want our listeners to remember are the women that we're talking about, the women who are still missing, the unidentified women.
So, right. And then I was wondering if there's a way for us to balance that. So, like, still name the names so they can take responsibility for what they've done, but also have, like, a balance of, like, remembering the women. So I don't know if you guys have any ideas on that or thoughts on us changing that or what you would want to hear.
You can always write to us.
Yeah. Write to us. We're on Facebook. We're on Instagram. Find us and tell us what you think, because it's hard for us sometimes to make these decisions on our own on, like, what you guys would want to hear.
Right.
While also staying true to, like, what we're trying to do here.
Exactly. Yeah.
So
I wanted to test out how I would feel mm-hmm. about that, like, to make an exception. And that exception comes at kind of the right time because, I decided to watch the new Netflix installment of Monster, the one focused on Ed Gein.
Right. I was kind of surprised by you doing this.
Yeah, because as I've said, to be completely honest, like, I do not usually watch any killer-based true crime shows or shows based on...
Right, you
killers.
Don't even watch the number of, like, documentaries that I do on
no.
true crime. So, like, while I'm not the true crime person and you are, it's mm-hmm. kind of a weird thing.
It is.
Because, like, I love documentaries, so I will watch one about basically anything. And a lot of the time, you know, our stations are, like, saturated with just true crime documentaries. So that's what I end up getting just by default.
Right. And so very often, like, people, when a... either a documentary comes out or a fictionalized version of, say, you know, Monster comes out, people mm-hmm. often want to talk to me about it.
Right.
And it just, like, to be honest, like, if you could open up my TikTok right now, my account, and look at my FYP page, it is, like, it's just good dogs. It's renovation tips. It's, like, these really capable, badass lesbians teaching me home improvement projects. Like, it's gardening. There's not a killer in sight.
Just all dogs and house stuff.
dogs, house stuff, books.
Yeah.
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 Cozy, which is fascinating because I hate most cozy things, but apparently the algorithm knows me better. Are you not
drawn to cozy?
Not cozy books. Don't give me a cozy book, but...
You like cozy everything else.
So yes.
Maybe that's... Yes. Maybe that's your cozy part. Not the book. You want to be like in the cozy clothes with the cozy drink in the cozy house.
Reading my nonfiction true crime book that's
your terribly uncomfortable book.
Right. And so
it's balance.
I was not planning to watch this show at all. I have not watched any of the others.
I have.
And you have. Until I heard the name.
So I already had like a ton of thoughts on the other ones. And I was not planning to watch this one because of those thoughts I had on the other ones. And then you're like, hey, do you think you can at least watch the first four episodes?
And you were like, why? And it's because I had heard the name Evelyn.
But,
Yes. And honestly, when I heard Evelyn's name, I ran for the remote because I was like, not my Evelyn. Because I think. I'm very defensive of people.
Right. But,
so, yes, today's episode is different, if you couldn't tell already.
Right. And I can tie back into why I had thoughts on it after, but I don't want to spoil anything that you're going to say either. Because, like, why I wasn't going to, I think is a lot of what you're going to be talking about. Yes, and so we'll get there.
Pinball. Because back
it's not
and forth.
That I have anything actually against these stories being told. I don't. But it's the way we tell them. And I think that's part of your.
Yes.
What's happening. What you're feeling right now because you got drawn in because of Evelyn. And then you're now feeling the way I felt about the other ones.
Right. I mean, I think.
Although I probably will continue past the fourth because, I mean, I'm not also one to leave things unfinished.
That's true. I have watched the entire series. I have thoughts. I have feelings. They're pretty nuanced. And complicated. Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
That's okay.
So, but I was drawn to this because I heard Evelyn's name and I was like, And Evelyn, I've carried her name with me for a very long time, her story with me. I knew we were going to talk about her at some point. And this was kind of an impetus for me to do so because learning that she was part of this series and depicted as one of the people that Ed Gein murdered just broke my heart.
So to be clear, this is the story of Evelyn Hartley, inspired by the new retelling of Ed Gein.
Yes. So
not the other way around.
Right. Yeah. Yes. So Evelyn Hartley is a real person. And kind of seeing the conversations that are arising out of having people view this show, like people are calling it a documentary.
That's okay. So it's not even a biography. It's not even a true story.
No.
It's its own thing. It's a series. Own thing. It's a series based on Ed Gein.
Yeah.
And the movies that are based off of him.
Right.
So a documentary is usually facts done by a documentarian who is neutral to the topic and not shaped in any way or form other than what they believe is true at the time.
Right.
So this is not this. And it's not usually with actors and this kind of stuff. You can have recreations, but it's not this. Just like for anyone who's like, wait, what is a documentary? Right. You know, so.
I think honestly, the fact that a lot of people grew up with reenactments as part of kind of either documentary movies or series has complicated our understanding.
So right, like Unsolved Mysteries. When you say recreations right away, I'm thinking Unsolved Mysteries. And a lot of us grew up watching that. Mm-hmm. But that is, like, they are trying to, on that particular show, they were trying to solve crimes. They were doing it as accurately as possible, but they were using those, like, visuals.
Exactly.
As, like, interest for us to keep watching. Like, it's, like, compelling, right?
Yeah. So this is not a documentary.
No.
And the filmmakers of Monster are purposefully not telling a straight story, and we can have a lot of feelings about that. Vanessa and I were just talking beforehand about how we feel about telling a straight true story based on Ed Gein's life, but that is not what they're doing here.
Right. So and I thoughts. But I mean there are differences with that because you can do it both ways. You can be as creative as you want, but you just can't say the so-and-so story.
Because you're like,
that's if you're not taking creative license with that. So like, you have to stick to just saying inspired by this person's story.
Yeah, I have a different view on that. Do you have which we're going to get into.
Okay.
So, but today we are going to be talking about Evelyn.
Right.
Okay. She's this bright, curious teenager who went missing in 1953 because, again, Evelyn Hartley is a real person. And we're going to talk about why anyone mentions Ed Gein in the same breath as her name and where fact and fiction diverge in the stories we tell and why that matters. So this is a kind of commentary on true crime and crime fiction and where we kind of rest with that. Mm-hmm. Because when we talk about real cases, we do have a responsibility to tell the truth, not to make myths. So before we talk about who Evelyn was and what really happened that October night, let's untangle the myth from the truth and address, well, the monster in the room. So let's dig in just for a minute who Ed Gein was and why we're talking about him right now. So this is especially for people who are unfamiliar with him or who have watched the new series and are struggling to separate truth from fiction. Edward Gein was born in 1906 in La Crosse, Wisconsin, which will matter later on to Evelyn's story.
The year or La Crosse, Wisconsin?
La Crosse, Wisconsin.
Okay, so I will keep La Crosse in my head.
Okay. He lived with his mother, Augusta, and his father, George, and his older brother, Henry. Augusta is often described as religiously fervent, abusive woman, and that's true. She really preached fire and brimstone, especially about sexuality, and she really did seem to despise other women.
All other women?
Well, she saw a lot of women as kind of like sexually promiscuous, like trying to lead people into temptation.
So like all women are there for us to like tempt men into you.
A lot, but she also really didn't like men necessarily.
So that's actually true. Like, yeah. So, because they did show that pretty much.
Yes.
So her demeanor is kind of accurate?
A lot of that, yes.
Okay.
But what's often left out is that George, Ed's father, was also abusive and an alcoholic.
Okay.
Now, most narratives, which includes the Netflix series, lay the blame for what Ed ends up doing squarely at his mother's feet. And in some ways, like, that is the easier story to tell. Because, yes, Ed did become fixated on his mother. But part of that obsession came from the fact that, despite her cruelty, she was the only consistent presence in his life. His father was mentally absent, if not physically. George died in 1940, so he could have counteracted like a lot of Augusta's abuse, but he didn't. And he was even a participant in his own abuse against Ed. And that's just unaddressed, I feel like.
Right. They kind of made his dad look wimpy in the series. Like, he's just like, oh.
Like, yeah.
Augusta was running the show.
Yeah. Augusta,
it seems like they were both a little bit in their own way there, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Augusta did run the show. Like, she didn't really see George as a trustworthy person. She often had to take over business dealings from him because he was an alcoholic and absent, right? Mm-hmm. But he was abusive to Ed as well. Now, when Augusta died a few years later after George, at this point, Ed was 39, and he's suddenly alone because by then, everyone in his family was gone, including his brother, Henry.
Now, in the series, mm-hmm. he's responsible for his brother's death.
Right. Glad you brought that up because this is where we start to like, what's truth? What's fiction?
Right.
Yeah. Now, in Monster, Ed is shown killing his brother and covering it up during a brush fire. And it's true that the two men were fighting a brush fire when Henry died. And it's true that the details were suspicious, but what actually happened is something only Ed Gein would know. Now, some believed Henry died of a heart attack, which his father actually died of.
Okay.
Others think Ed killed him. Ed always denied it, but denial doesn't always equal innocence, particularly since Ed had difficulty owning up to the murders he is known to have committed.
Okay.
So after Augusta's death, Ed's world suddenly became smaller. And for all of her contradictions, She had been his North Star in life, and once she was gone, he drifted and even became even more isolated than he had been. That's when the grave robbing starts. Around 1947, he started exhuming the bodies of older women from cemeteries in the area and bringing them home and using parts of their bodies to create household objects and clothing. And those details have been documented and really sensationalized elsewhere, so we don't actually need to repeat them all here. Mm-hmm. But what matters is Ed's fascination was focused on a type of transformation, so on skin and identity, and it escalated.
Yes. It was like some sort of very dark crafting projects happening that we don't need to talk about, but that's enough.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You'll see if you watch the, like the...
Yeah, or if you look up if anything. If you watch the
series or if you look up anything, there's definitely some human arts and crafts going on.
Yes.
Now, one of the things is I think they did show him like trying to dig up his mother. Mm-hmm. But then it like opens up this curiosity. Had he been able to successfully dig up his mother, because that actually did happen in real life,
right?
Would he have been able to stop there? Would it have not done like... I wonder if just like that would have been enough. He wanted his mom back so badly.
Yeah.
And it was just a curiosity I had while I was watching. I'm like, if he would have succeeded on this one, maybe all the rest of the stuff would not have happened.
Like where...
There's no way of knowing that now, obviously. No. But it's just a thing to think about.
But to ponder.
To ponder. Because that's the kind of thing I ponder.
Now, he goes from grave robbing to murder. Mm-hmm. And in 1954, he does kill a bar owner named Mary Hogan. 3 years later, in 1957, he murders Bernice Warden, who owned the hardware store. It was actually Bernice's disappearance that finally led police to Ed's farmhouse and everything he had done. He was institutionalized soon after, and he was diagnosed with schizophrenia. And as I was thinking about like what to say here, I came across a comment online from someone who said she felt sympathy for Ed while watching Monster.
Okay.
And I don't think that that's a bad thing.
Right. I mean, he definitely is the victim of abuse, and he definitely is suffering from a mental illness.
Exactly.
So we can sympathize with the human side of him, but that's not an excuse.
Also hold him accountable.
Right. Like, also hold him accountable.
Both things.
Right. And also, not everyone who has schizophrenia becomes an Ed Gein.
Right.
Almost none of them do, except for Ed Gein.
Yeah. Like,
so it's one of those things too. It's like,
Because I say all the time, you know, that I'm not personally interested in killers or their rationales. And by that, I'm not interested in glorifying them in any way.
Right.
Right. But we can, as you said, like, understand someone's humanity without excusing their harm.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You usually aren't too interested in that. Like I said, you do have the you can feel for them, especially when they're children and before these things happen. I am kind of interested in it, but I also hate how it gets tied up in that thing of like, well, their mental illness caused them to do this. As somebody who's like very into like mental health, I really, really don't love that part because so many people have mental illnesses and don't commit crimes.
Exactly. And
the vast majority.
The vast majority. And people who have mental illnesses are actually much more likely to become victims of crimes. And that's especially true for schizophrenia. It's something I think about a lot because one of my brothers is diagnosed with schizophrenia. So I think about like what harm could happen to him.
Right.
Because of that, right?
Right.
Now, what I think Monster does want from us is for us to feel conflicted, to see Ed as both a product of his environment, of his mother, of his trauma, of violent comic books and World War II imagery. And the series creators have said that they wanted to turn the camera around on us, to make us examine why we consume these stories, and to critique our own decision to watch what they produced.
Okay. So, I mean, that's like a solid want, I guess.
Yeah. So in the series, you'll see, you know, the fourth wall is broken a few times in which it's like we're being addressed as the viewer, right? But here's the thing about all of this. One of the conversations I've had at dinner, actually, because this is the kind of thing we talk about at the dinner table.
Why not?
was about why the series is called Monster the Ed Gein Story, which is something that you're like,
That part doesn't, yeah.
Yeah.
Doesn't when sit well with me.
So much of it is simply not true. Like, mm-hmm. they add more murders, they invent a girlfriend, they have him taking part in the capture of Ted Bundy. Mm. So how can it be subtitled the Ed Gein Story? And I think it, like, in one sense, that's the point. The show itself becomes about the mythologization of Ed Gein. In the final episode, which Vanessa will get there, mm-hmm. when Ed is dying of cancer, he's told that the stories being told about him aren't accurate and that he should write down his own story. And he says essentially that there's already enough stories about him. That's one of the show's central arguments. The myth of Ed Gein has become bigger than the man himself.
I guess my main problem with that being called the Ed Gein story is that some people will take that at face value and think right. this is his story. Mm-hmm. And then it does lead us to having people like Evelyn kind of fall between the cracks.
Yeah. So it's true. Yeah. So it's just like, unless you actually sit with this and think it
right. through. Like, I just need people to understand that are watching it, that it's not actually his story. Like, it's just been misnamed.
Well, so it's not his actual personal story, but like right. what the filmmakers are trying to say is that his story has become all of the stories that we tell about him.
Okay. I'm getting what you're saying, but I also know that that a lot of people will take that as face value.
Right,
without actually thinking about like the story beyond the story.
Right. Like, what am I actually like thinking about?
The story in the sense of the word story. As opposed to the story in, like, accurate like retelling factual. Of true yeah. crime people, you know?
Right.
Like, the people who commit these things.
Yeah. So. Now, the filmmakers, they say they want their work to turn its lens on us. And I think in doing so, they give themselves a pass. Because if they were truly interested in exploring how violent imagery affects us, which is what they state explicitly that they wanted to do with Ed's story... What does it mean that they've taken a real missing teenage girl, Evelyn Hartley, and turned her into a fictionalized, violently aesthetic murder scene? Mm-hmm. What does it mean if we're going to create empathy for a killer while turning his supposed victim into art? Mm-hmm. Because that's what they've done. And that brings me to Evelyn Hartley, or if you've watched the series, The Babysitter. The first time we encounter Evelyn's name in Monster is when Ed Gein sits down with a mother to be interviewed for a job babysitting two young children. The woman explains that Evelyn, their regular babysitter, has just been hospitalized with polio and can't care for the kids. And later we catch our first glimpse of Evelyn as the camera focuses first on her legs, one in a brace, as she's making her way down the street. As the episode unfolds, Gein traumatizes the children and is barred from babysitting them. Evelyn recovers enough to return from her job, but soon Ed kidnaps her, angered that she's taken his place babysitting. And then over the course of two episodes, Monster shows Ed Gein murdering Evelyn.
What do you think of that as motive? Like, you took my babysitting job.
Yeah. I think the thing that just I wrestle with
the story
the most is the whole Evelyn story
right.
in this, right? Now, when actress Addison Rae was asked about her role of Evelyn and she told Netflix's Tudum, Evelyn in the story is a babysitter to two really sweet children. I did research before I filmed Evelyn. There's not much about her. They don't really know exactly what happened in real life. So it was really interesting for me as an actor to lean into something that there was minimal information about. Addison Rae, to be clear, I just want to make this clear. She does a commendable mm-hmm. job in her role and in the role she was given. But let's sit with that statement for just a minute. Evelyn was, yes, a real person. Evelyn was, yes, a babysitter. And Evelyn was, yes, a victim, but not of Ed Gein.
Right. So what are your thoughts on that? Because I feel like you have some thoughts. So like we will say the actress did a phenomenal job of mm-hmm. just being like this really great babysitting teenager, you know.
Right.
But like you have some feelings about just like that, right?
Yeah, because when we look at this, like, it's in their attempt to recreate the mythologies surrounding Endgame, the show re-victimizes Evelyn, who is a young woman. She had her own story, her own real story that we actually know a lot about, right? And like, that deserves to be heard. And so where is the real Evelyn?
So there is actually quite a bit of information about Evelyn?
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
Are you going to tell us?
Of course.
Okay.
Because
I knew you were getting there.
I just know.
I'm going to ask because, you know.
Yeah, because as much as like we've already devoted to this episode about Endgame, the film, etc. Like,
right.
Evelyn is overshadowed, right? Mm-hmm. So Evelyn Hartley, she was born in 1937. Her father, Richard, was a university professor. And like, now that actually meant that the family, which included Evelyn's older brothers, Richard and Tom, and younger sister Karen, they moved around a lot to follow his academic career. They started off in Iowa until 1943, then moved on to Lamar College in Texas, and then later to Eastern Illinois University. It's while they were in Texas, though, that tragedy struck. Richard, the older brother of Evelyn, passed away from polio in 1946.
And they have Evelyn with polio. So does she have it too?
No. I have a lot of feelings about having a fictionalized version of Evelyn dealing with the effects of the same illness that killed the real Evelyn's brother.
Yeah. They like borrowed his disease.
Yeah.
Gave it to her.
Mm-hmm.
Borrowed her as a victim.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, she is a victim, but like, I guess one of the hopes is that like, people don't think that this is what happened to her and then stop trying to figure out what did.
Exactly.
Because like, there's a lot of like, push mm-hmm. sometimes from like online sleuths, right?
Right.
To like, solve these cases. And
right.
maybe it should be.
Well, yeah, so hopefully we recenter her case. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as much as I don't like necessarily talking about Endgame, if that's people's entry point into this story and that they can sit down and actually hear Evelyn's real story and learn to separate the fact from fiction, like that would be good, right?
Right. Awareness.
Yeah. So in 1950, the family moves and settles in La Crosse, Wisconsin, where her father joined the faculty at the university there.
And that's where Edgeen was born. That was the place we had to remember.
Exactly.
Although I remember the year too, I think.
Do you?
1906?
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, so
you're very surprised by this.
Well, we've covered a lot of ground since then.
I know. Okay.
Now, this is the small thread that connects Evelyn and Ed. He'd been born in La Crosse in 1906, but his family moved to Plainfield, which is more than 100 miles away, when he was around 8 years old. That was decades before Evelyn was even born. Mm. So the connection between them is practically non-existent. Now, Ed's experience of La Crosse and Evelyn's couldn't be more different. His mother saw La Crosse as kind of a den of sin, and she wanted to escape it. So that's why they moved to a very rural farm. Yes.
Huh. Okay.
Yeah. Now, for Evelyn, La Crosse was simply like a peaceful college town, a place full of young families, students, and opportunity.
What is it? Is it a peaceful town or is it a den of sin?
I mean, Augusta, I think, saw basically everything as sinful. So.
Okay.
Now, Evelyn attended one of the local schools affiliated with the university's teaching program. It was designed as kind of a training school for future educators. So, like, this is cutting-edge education at the time. Now, the classes were very small, only 18 students per grade, and it was filled mostly with faculty kids, and it was known for this progressive approach to learning. By her junior year, Evelyn was thriving there. She was active in the musical society and the science club and served on the Honor Study Hall Council, which I don't know what that is, but it sounds very serious.
It sounds extremely serious.
She was quiet and reserved, but Evelyn had a few close friends, Mary, Merritt, and Nancy, and they formed kind of a tight-knit circle. They would bike together, they'd have sleepovers, they'd explore town together. They were pretty locked in. Despite her quiet nature, she also had a daring streak, though. This is my favorite story. One morning at a sleepover, the girls snuck out at dawn, biked to the local pool, and jumped in their pajamas.
Very timid, daring streak.
Yeah. And her friend Mary would later say, "We had to do something daring, but it wasn't malicious, just goofy kids stuff."
We'll be back in a moment.
Now, outside of school, Evelyn spent much of her time with her family. They attended church. They would often go hiking. One of her brother's friends remembered her as fearless, saying Evelyn was one of those who could handle snakes and everything. She was really into those animal things. By October 1953, Evelyn was trying to step out of her comfort zone. She auditioned for the Girls' Drama Club, which she would have to practice a dramatic reading under the mentorship of an upperclassman. She was given Carol as her kind of mentor for this. Carol later recalled, "I just thought she was really quiet. It struck me as strange that someone so quiet and soft-spoken was in the drama club." It's just such a human moment. We've got this quiet girl who's kind of testing her own confidence. And I really want, this is the version of Evelyn that we should remember. Not the fiction, not the myth. There's a real girl in La Crosse who was just beginning to step into herself. But that brings us to the night of October 24th, 1953. It's the night of the big La Crosse State football homecoming game against River Falls. Everyone in town, it felt like, was going, which meant babysitters were in high demand. Evelyn had never babysat for Dr. Viggo Rasmussen's family before, but he and her father knew each other from the university. Evelyn is a solid pick as a babysitter to watch over their youngest 18-month-old, Janice. Evelyn would only be in charge of one of the Rasmussen children. Their older daughter, Roslyn, was going to the game with them, and it was her first time going to a game. Dr. Rasmussen drove the 5 minutes to Evelyn's house and picked her up, and Evelyn got in the car dressed in a white blouse and red denim pants. Evelyn and Mary actually owned the same outfit, sometimes dressing identically, so I'm guessing this was a favorite outfit of hers. The Rasmussens lived at 2415 Hochler Drive, which was in a tiny little ranch house that they had recently been built as part of a subdivision. They had just moved there that summer, and it was their dream home, and it was part of the city's growth on the south side of town. The Rasmussens' home was one of the first to have been built, and most of the subdivision was still consisting of empty lots. Not even the streetlights had been installed yet. Before they left, Madeline Rasmussen went over the babysitting instructions, which were pretty minimal. Janice was already asleep, and all Evelyn needed to do was check on her about 30 minutes later to make sure that she was covered up. For Evelyn, it looked like an easy night. She was a straight A student, and she'd brought along all of her textbooks to study while the baby slept. At about 6:45 p.m., the Rasmussens departed for the game, leaving Evelyn and Janice alone. Now, back at the Hartley house, Evelyn's parents were waiting for her routine 8:30 p.m. check-in call. She never missed it when she was out babysitting. But 8:30 came and went, and there was no ring of the phone. Her father, Richard, tried calling the Rasmussen house. The phone rang and rang. No answer. Thinking perhaps Evelyn had stepped next door to a neighbor's, he tried their numbers too, and no one had seen her.
What an unusual time, right? When you have neighbors' phone numbers. Everybody's around.
And you could just be who lives next door to the Rasmussens?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Now, he's doing all these calls. He's frantic a little bit, I think, at this point. 9 p.m., the worry takes over. He gets in his car. He drives the same 5-minute route that his daughter had taken earlier that evening. When he arrived, everything looked normal. The lights were on and music was playing on the radio inside. And so he rang the doorbell and no one came to the door. He tried the front door. It was locked, just as it should have been. Circling the house, he tried the back door, also locked, and no answer to the doorbell. Then, looping around the house, Richard saw it. One of the screens from a basement window was propped against the siding. That window, the only one in the house that wasn't locked. Heart pounding, he climbed down through the opening in the window. He, like, literally went into...
He kind of broke in.
He did.
Looking for his daughter.
Mm-hmm. Huh. Now, he's going in through this basement window. You know, he's expecting kind of a drop on the other side, but mm-hmm. there's not one. His foot actually catches on a small ladder that's just inside the basement. So he gets into the basement, starts moving through to the stairs, and there at the bottom of the stairs was one of Evelyn's shoes. This confirmed kind of everything that he didn't want to believe, and he ran upstairs. The crime scene photos would later capture what Richard saw in the living room. Evelyn's glasses were neatly folded and tipped upside down on the floor. A single one of her shoes was flopped on its side as though it had been kicked off. And blood, which looked like dark smears in the black and white photos, but in that moment would have been unmistakable. Inside the nursery, baby Janice was still asleep, but Evelyn was gone. The search for Evelyn begins immediately. Rushing to a neighbor's house, Richard phones the police from there, and soon over 20 officers actually descend on the Rasmussen home. From the beginning, no one questioned whether something terrible had happened. It was pretty clear. Mm-hmm. Circling the home, investigators found that someone had tried to pry open three other windows before finally entering through the basement window. In the dirt outside were footprints from tennis shoes. Richard stayed pretty close to law enforcement as they moved around the property again, and that's when they found something he hadn't noticed in his frantic search originally, a pool of blood about 10 feet from the basement window. It was 18 inches wide.
Inside the house or outside?
Outside the house.
Outside, okay.
So it must have been clear in that moment that whatever had happened to Evelyn was unlikely something that she could have survived because
too much
that blood. Is a lot of blood. The trail of blood, which they found, actually led from the house towards the garage. Later on, by dawn, when they had better lighting, they actually found more along a neighbor's garage wall, and police believe that the marks were left by Evelyn's hand as maybe she was dragged or carried past. Evelyn's mother, Ethel, would later walk this scene herself, tracing the same path, and she told reporters quietly, "We know she isn't alive now." Even so, the search began with the kind of intensity that we rarely see in missing persons cases. George Brooks, one of Wisconsin's best-known searchers, lived in La Crosse, and he brought his bloodhounds, who tracked a scent from the basement window to Sisson Drive and then to Cooley Drive, where the trail vanished. Brooks believed that Evelyn had been taken from that area by a car at that point, so his dogs couldn't follow the scent. That theory was supported by a witness whose name is Ed Hofer, who had come forward soon after the reports of Evelyn going missing reached the news. He told police that on the night of Evelyn's disappearance, he'd been on his way to pick up his brother when he saw two men staggering under the weight of a girl between them. Her head kind of rested on one man's shoulder and her arm was like kind of swinging loosely. And I feel like, Vanessa, you're thinking like, why didn't he do mm-hmm. something?
I'm sure everybody's thinking that. Are yes. you gonna tell us?
Well, I mean, Ed Hofer also later on is like, why didn't I do something if I had just done
oh,
something?
No, yeah. Ed.
He said at the time he thought it was this. He said in his quote, "I thought it was somebody celebrating ahead of time for the homecoming game."
Like drunk?
Yeah. Okay. So he thought it was like a bunch of drunk people who had gotten okay. inebriated beforehand. Yeah.
I mean, he could think that.
Yeah.
I mean, why would you wouldn't think it's like a murder victim.
Right. Right. You would not.
That's okay. So I'm going to say that what he thought is probably what would most likely be what most people would think.
Right.
Okay.
Now, he goes into his brother's house, comes out a few minutes later in his car, and he sees a two-toned green Buick drive past with a girl kind of slumped in the back seat. So could that have been Evelyn that he witnessed?
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't sure of the time, but he placed it around 7:15 p.m., which was 15 minutes before kickoff, because he was going to the game.
Wow, so that's just only like 30 minutes after you said her parents left?
Mm-hmm. This happened so fast.
So by the time she wasn't calling at 8:30.
That's long.
Whoa.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Now, as word spread through the cross, more witnesses kind of came forward. A neighbor had heard a scream about 7. So that's 15 minutes.
She'd only been at the house for 15 minutes?
Yeah.
Had somebody even... How could they even follow her? Because she was in the car with Janice's dad.
I have a lot of theories. Like, we're talking... This is a neighborhood under construction, right?
That just seems too quick.
It's so quick.
15 minutes later, the person tried 3 windows, mm-hmm. went in through the basement.
It's like...
Got her back out at that point.
I feel like the Rasmussens left, and this person immediately...
So, like, they were watching.
Yeah, I think so.
How would they know? And it's just... The whole thing is like, so quick.
Mm-hmm.
It's really scary, isn't it, to think?
So frightening. And I think when I started encountering and thinking about missing persons cases, that's one of the things that struck me the most is, like, how tiny the time frames are, right?
Right. So 6:45, she's left alone.
Mm-hmm.
7 o'clock, they already hear a scream. 7:15, she's already...
potentially seen.
Leaving the property.
Right. Now, the person who heard the scream, they thought it was, like, neighborhood kids playing. So they also didn't suspect anything at the time. Now, this seems to confirm a timeline that police were already thinking. Evelyn was incredibly responsible, and she had never actually pulled up the covers over Janice. So if you remember, the mom said pull the blankets up about half an hour later, which would have been 7:15.
That never happened.
Yeah. But even with all these tips, police knew the kidnapper had hours of lead time. Because as you just said, by the time 8:30 rolls around, we're hours out.
Mm-hmm.
And then the crime scene was quickly compromised. Within hours, hundreds of onlookers had crowded around the Rasmussen home, trampling through the yard and the neighboring lots, eager to get a look at the crime scene, which I guess is...
How did they know? Where did these people come from? Did they leave the football game?
So... This is by the next morning, right? So this is happening at night.
Oh, okay. The next morning.
The next morning, they're like essentially at church. The next day is a Sunday morning at church, and people are gossiping like, did you hear? Did you hear? Did you hear?
So they all run to the house?
Yeah, because they want to see.
Ooh.
Which, by the way, is exactly what the filmmakers of Ed Gein are kind of trying to talk about. Our desire to see.
Okay.
Yeah.
I guess. Mm. Yeah, yeah.
We'll give them that. But
okay, we will give them that.
The next day, Evelyn's classmates joined a search along with thousands of other people. They're walking shoulder to shoulder through fields, ravines, empty lots. And police start questioning local sex offenders and then anyone who seemed like off to them. Like, you seem like a suspicious character, right?
How could you even... Sorry, sir. You seem off. I am going to ask you some questions now.
Literally. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Huh. Okay.
They even dragged Lakes as far away as Minnesota looking for her. And across the country, headlines were asking the same thing. Where is Evelyn Hartley? But back in La Crosse, like, the search gets to be more desperate. Police began inspecting every vehicle in the area for signs or blood or struggle. Like, the effort's massive. Like, 40,000 cars massive. Owners were told to bring their cars to local gas stations where they would be searched and then cleared. And once they did, they received a sticker that said, my car is okay. Like, that's what the sticker said.
Kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm. Then came the most significant find. A pair of size 11 tennis shoes were discovered along U.S. Highway 14. The pattern on the soles matched the prints in the Rasmussen's flower bed and the footprints inside their living room.
Mm-hmm.
And human blood was found on these shoes. It was type A, which was Evelyn's blood type. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's, I mean, they're doing some pretty good detective work for this case, like, given the year and how little we usually see of this, even in much more recent cases. The level of care that they're putting on this, like, the cars with the stickers, that's just kind of cool. This car is okay.
Yeah. I mean, they take a lot of heat for their handling of this case, to be clear.
Oh, do they?
Yeah. I mean, I think because it just never results in anything, right? Now, they have the only thing they have is this pair of shoes, mm-hmm. right? They discovered they're this brand Goodrich, but they're this specific type called the Hood Mogul style, which was actually quite common throughout the Midwest, right? They're like, we found shoes. Oh, they're common.
Okay.
So the investigators,
they did have the blood.
They did have the blood. Mm-hmm. I mean, the other complication, though, is that Evelyn is type A, which is like, it's the most common kind.
Okay. Okay.
Right. So they're left studying these shoes, kind of investigating their wear pattern, trying to decide if they match the prints. They decide they match the prints, right? Now, they determined, though, from the wearing on the shoes that they felt like the shoes had been worn by two people, two different people.
Hmm. Why?
Well, it could be like secondhand shoes.
Okay.
Right. And one of the people who wore them, like their feet were too large for the shoe. So they're like stretching the like leather essentially. Also,
could it be somebody trying to make their feet look smaller?
I mean, it could be.
Considering that,
I don't know.
Like, the whole like shoe print thing seems to have been big then based on the cartoons that we watched in the 80s and 90s.
Right. But I think like the wear pattern indicates that probably this person with the bigger feet, mm-hmm. the size 12 feet, not size 11 feet, was probably wearing them for a while.
Okay.
Rather than some sort of like subterfuge. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. The other thing is that at least one of the owners of the pair of shoes looks to have owned a Whizzer motorbike.
It's oddly specific.
Yeah. So the Wizard was a specific type of motorbike that it was like a pedal start.
The Whizzer?
Yeah.
It's a very cool name.
Right. So it's kind of like almost like a bike hybrid. So you would have to like pedal it to start the engine.
Okay.
Okay. And then like, so there's like some telltale scuffing from like that pedal starting on the shoes. A month later, on November 17th, a farmer found a bloodstained jacket along the same highway. He had seen it before. He had thrown it in the back of his truck, and he kind of just forgot about it until the news coverage jogged his memory. The sleeves, front and back, were soaked with blood, and the jacket had these shallow, custom-altered pockets. So they made them, like, really shallow, like 2 inches, which led investigators to believe it was altered this way for a particular profession.
Why would anyone want shallower pockets?
Yeah, I mean, like, I guess it's, like, something if you need to, like, pluck something out, like, really easily. I'm not sure. Huh. But, yeah, okay. They're, like, practically decorative at that level, right? Now, like, the shoes, though, this led nowhere. As months passed, investigators grew more desperate. They administered lie detector tests to more than 2,000 people in what's believed to be the largest polygraph sweep in U.S. history. Evelyn's father had actually been given a test much earlier, and that was to clear him and kind of silence some rumors about his involvement. But this new wave targeted male students, teachers, and professors across La Crosse's schools and colleges.
New wave of, so is that included in the 2,000 people?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How do you even polygraph 2,000 people?
It was a lot. I mean, I think.
How long does that take?
Oh, much more time than they initially believed, right? So the polygraph itself, the tests would only have lasted about 15 minutes per person. Although once you start calculating 15 times, you know, 2,000, you get to some pretty astronomical numbers. Right. But the other thing is like the bringing people in, the setting them up, the getting them ready, that all took a lot of time.
So long. But also, can you talk to us for a minute about why Evelyn's father? I guess I hadn't even thought of him as like being a suspect.
Right. I mean, I think, you know, one, primarily because he had gone to the house, he had gone into the house, right?
Okay. He was the first one on the scene.
Exactly.
Is that what would make him, but like, was he at home with her mom? Like, right. What was he before that?
So that seems like a little suspicious for some people. The other thing that ends up happening is like, I don't know. Okay. So to be clear, he's a professor of zoology.
That's pretty cool.
Yes. And so he's really like practical and scientific minded, right? And at the same time, what I'm about to say indicates some lack of understanding about female bodies. But he sees the blood and he says essentially like, maybe that's her menstrual blood.
Then the girl's got a problem.
Right. Like she's
hemorrhaging. An 18-inch circle of menstrual blood.
Yeah.
Seems not like your typical period.
Exactly. So this does to me indicate that maybe not a full understanding of menstruation, right?
It might indicate that.
But at the time, this is 1953, and instead the officers there get weirded out that he mentions menstruation.
That's the part they're weirded out about?
Yes.
I'm weirded out about him not knowing the volume of blood a young girl would have during her period, not about him mentioning his daughter's period.
Yeah. So no, they're like, I would never mention my daughter's period ever. How can this man know about periods and that his daughter is having her period? Because he didn't know she was having her period at the time. Yeah.
Because he lives with her.
Yeah.
He's her father. But anyways.
Okay. So that's part of why he falls under suspicion. So he's just like, he takes the test just to like quell any rumors and just kind of move on past
it. But also that doesn't mean anything right now from what we know of polygraphs. But anyways.
Oh, yeah.
Just, yeah.
Now, again, this is a massive undertaking.
It's a lot. Like the amount of cars searched, the amount of people questioned.
Now, with these lie detector tests, the results were inconclusive, right? And then the tests, they took too long, and then morale sagged and no new leads developed, right?
Just even questioning 2,000 people would take forever.
Exactly.
Setting up the tests? Jeez.
Now, by 1954, it was clear that Evelyn's disappearance would become one of LaCrosse's unsolved crimes, which was just another case in a string of murders and vanishings that this department had failed to close.
That's why happening in LaCrosse?
Yeah.
So maybe it is a den of sin.
I mean,
Augusta might be right.
I don't think Augusta was right about anything.
She's on to something, Amy.
No. Okay. Now, so Evelyn's not brought home. And though the case has been revisited again and again through the years, Evelyn's story has really drifted into obscurity. It's just one more missing girl in the long shadow of Americans' forgotten teenagers, except...
Do you think that's maybe why she was chosen for this? Because there's no ending to her story, so they're just like, okay.
Oh, why she was chosen for the series?
Yeah.
Well, it goes a little bit further than that. So Evelyn, okay, let me clear up some things. So the search for Evelyn, it stretches on, right? And the facts kind of begin to fade into stories. Mm-hmm. People really wanted answers. And then the absence of answers, that's when myths start to grow.
Okay. So we are already in that mind frame. Then
yes.
Is what you're getting at?
Yes.
Is that what you're now inching towards?
I am inching slowly. Now, okay. In the 72-year search for Evelyn, thousands of individuals were questioned. Again, this is a massive investigative case, right? Mm-hmm. And one of those people was, Ed Gein, who was questioned for about 1 hour about possible involvement with Evelyn's disappearance and likely, let's face it, murder.
That wasn't a very long question for an hour.
No.
And he was already, in jail?
Yeah, so he's always, he was institutionalized.
He was already known for his crimes and put somewhere
exactly.
At this point.
Yeah, so they question him after as kind of a host of cases that they actually ask him about. But
so if it was only an hour, it makes me think they didn't, right away, they're like, nope.
Well, Evelyn never fit Ed Gein's kind of victim profile.
Okay.
His targets tend to be older white women who, in his mind, resembled or reminded him of his own mother, right?
And Evelyn would not.
No.
Not at all.
And yeah. Plainfield, the town where Gein lived, again, it's 100 miles mm-hmm. from LaCrosse, which is a long way to travel in the first place. But again, in one of his battered old trucks, highly unlikely.
Also, didn't you say he was kind of almost like he had shrunken his world down to just his house mostly and just going out a little bit?
Yeah, so he really stuck around his farm.
He's not a wandering guy.
No, and then the two women he murdered, those were close to Plainfield, and also the cemeteries that he stole women's bodies from, those were close by as well.
Okay, so it just seems, like I said, if they only questioned him for an hour, it seems like everything was...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So When I still hear people say that they believe very firmly that Ed Gein kidnapped and killed Evelyn, I'm just going to need you all to sit down. Like,
you don't want to hear it.
I don't. No. Now, over the years, far more plausible suspects have surfaced, including one chilling barroom recording where two kind of rough men from the area allegedly talk about their role in her abduction. To be clear, I'm not including more of that in here because, like many of the leads in Evelyn's case, this ends up not getting any traction, at least publicly.
Okay. So you think it's more plausible, but you don't think that they did it because it never got...
Well, I think it's plausible, but I'm...
And that one man, the witness, said there was two guys.
Right. I think it fits a lot of potentially what was going in La Crosse in that time.
It didn't go anywhere, though.
You know, we're kind of, it's just like that came out in 2004, and here we are 21 years later, and what happened to that,
okay, right? But still more plausible than Ed Gein.
Exactly.
Okay.
Now, Evelyn's disappearance, though, it fundamentally changed the way people in La Crosse saw the world. The Rasmussens quickly sold their dream home. They were too heartbroken and too afraid to stay in the place where violence had come in through the window and changed everything. And around town, people installed bars on their windows. And teens started to turn down babysitting jobs.
It's funny because I guess through this conversation, I hadn't really thought of the impact on the Rasmussens themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing happened to their girls, but that house became...
Yeah.
Like you said, there's hundreds of people standing, staring at their house.
Exactly. Ugh. Now, Rosalind, who is the Rasmussen's daughter, she was the one who went with them that mm-hmm. night. She was 7, right? She said that they returned home because remember, they're gone when all of this is happening. They come home to find police combing through their yard. In 2017, she told a reporter, "As long as I live, I will never forget coming home to that horrific scene, blood everywhere, police everywhere, and the feeling of total fear and loss. Not only was it a turning point for the town, but for us as well."
So even at 7, she felt it.
Yeah. And she ended up moving away from La Crosse basically as soon as possible. And she was really haunted by Evelyn's disappearance. And she said, "If I hadn't gone to that game, I might not be alive either. I kind of feel like now Evelyn is kind of an angel. What a martyr she was. She gave up her life to protect my baby sister."
Yeah, it's like a child's take on what happened. And I can see that like staying with her.
Yeah. And so you start to think like it's all the what ifs.
Her whole life is like hinged on this one
yeah.
event that happened.
Mm-hmm. Like what if I had stayed? Or what if we hadn't gone to the game that night? What if?
What if my sister would have cried? What yeah. if something, you know, there's probably all of those things like mm-hmm. through her head.
Ooh. Now, for Evelyn's friends and family, the grief was deeper, quieter, harder to shake. Her siblings at some point cut off all contact with reporters. Like they don't want to talk about it or didn't want to talk about it. Her friend Mary, though, would later say, "I just treasured her. I just feel sad so often about what happened to her. It changed how I live. I just have a hard time with it. I feel so awful that it had to be her, and she was such a wonderful person. She really was. I missed her so very much, but I stayed very close to her family." And earlier I had mentioned Mary's the one who had like the same outfit as Evelyn.
Mm-hmm.
They would dress up together. And Mary actually had to turn over that clothing to the state police.
Her matching outfit?
Her matching outfit because in case Evelyn was ever found.
They could match the clothes.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Once Evelyn was this bright and vibrant teen with like a 10,000-watt smile, but who she was, who she could have been, has been eclipsed by the narrative that was never hers to begin with. Even here, as I say her name, I am forever linking it with his.
Mm-hmm. And it shouldn't be so.
Right. That's like kind of the paradox of true crime, right? Like how easily a woman's story is absorbed into kind of a man's legend. how quickly she becomes the footnote in someone else's horror. But Evelyn, she shouldn't be remembered as someone else's tragedy. She should be remembered as the center of her own story. In the Ed Gein series, we watch as Evelyn's hair falls in kind of perfect cascading waves as she sits in her satin underwear, bound up in Ed Gein's house. There's light streaming across her face, just so, highlighting one side of it. Later, her body is wrapped in a white gauzy cloth, as if the camera is staging a tableau rather than depicting a real girl who was taken from her family. This is the danger of storytelling when it confuses myth and reality. It can resurrect the truth, or it can bury it deeper. Monster, the Ed Gein story, does the latter for Evelyn. It takes Evelyn's life, the mystery, the grief, the love that surrounded her, and it layers it beneath the spectacle of Gein's crimes. And it transforms her murder into something visually beautiful for viewers to consume, which effectively aesthetizing her trauma, right?
I noticed that too, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is a certain feeling when they're trying to add beauty to a murder scene, mm-hmm. right? Like, and that scene definitely was that kind of like, how can we visually make this
pleasing?
Yeah.
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 Evelyn is not a character in a horror story. She's a real person. She had friends who loved her deeply, and I want to imagine them in that moment that I said earlier, sneaking off to the municipal pool, swimming in the early morning hours and watching the sunrise as they laugh at their own daring. Evelyn had a life that was stolen, and it deserves to be remembered on its own terms. Again, 72 years have passed since Evelyn vanished. She's not a myth. She is a girl who should have come home. And her story should not be eclipsed by someone else's legend. I think we both believe, that filmmakers and storytellers hold power over memory. When real lives are folded into myths, when trauma is shaped by aesthetics, we risk turning people into props for someone else's story. Evelyn Hartley deserves better than that. Her life, her laughter, her courage should be remembered, not repurposed. Swimming, Wisconsin. Evelyn Hartley, 16, missing since October 24th, 1953, from La Crosse, Wisconsin. Someday we will all know the weightlessness of floating. Arms starfished against the bright blue water. I think of every motel pool I slid my body into, turquoise squares scattered across the country like constellations. I never swam at dawn, never watched the sunrise wash across the horizon, never slid my hand across the surface, dove into those chlorinated depths as I wished for one more minute. Let us wait here. Our friends' arms snaked around our own, nightgowns floating around our waists, a laugh at our lips. What if we stay here, just before we get on our bikes and pedal home? What if we just stay, again and again?
For more information about our show, please visit shegoesbyjanepodcast.com.
Bye, Vanessa.
Bye, Amy.